Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this episode, what value do we attribute to education? It is common to hear how it changes lives, promotes imagination and creativity, and invites opportunity. It is often a social endeavor, and thus encourages the wide sharing of ideas and knowledge. The founders of Washington State clearly valued the concept of education. Article 9 of our Constitution states that it is the paramount duty of the state to make ample provision for the education of all children residing within its borders, without distinction or preference on account of race, color, caste, or sex. George Washington Carver wrote that education is, quote, the key to unlock the golden door of freedom. And Nelson Mandela famously referred to it as, quote, the most powerful weapon which you can use to change the world. Fair enough, inspiring enough, but what's the reality? If you are one of the students of color who make up 44% of the population of Washington State public grade schools, what does it mean that only 10% of your teachers look like you? Why is that the case, and what should be done to remedy the situation? Those are questions addressed at this recent panel discussion, hashtag EducationSoWhite. The panelists were Sharon Navas, Jesse Hagopian, Saraswati Noel, Joy Williamson-Lott, and Nathan Simoneau. Seattle Times education editor Linda Shaw served as moderator. This discussion took place at Town Hall Seattle on June 15th. Thanks to Jenny Cecil Moore for our recording. We're presenting our broadcast version here. You'll find the full event on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum.
I just want to say, as part of Education Lab, equity has been one of the major themes we've explored in part of our coverage when it comes to school discipline, as well as gifted education, access to rigorous courses, and also school finance. And also the makeup of the teaching force. We recently wrote about a report from the University of Washington that found that even as the diversity of our student body in Washington State is increasingly getting more diverse, the teaching force is getting less diverse. I think they pegged it now at 90% of the 60,000 teachers in Washington State are white. So that's one of the issues we'll address tonight, along with many others. So let's get started. And I thought I'd start by asking each of our panelists to say a little bit about what communities they identify with, as well as when they were in school, did they have very many teachers that shared their background? Saraswati?
So again, my name is Saraswati Noel, and I identify as biracial, as Malaysian, Indian, and white. And I moved to the U.S. When I was 3 from Malaysia. And in my school, I went to Roosevelt High School in Seattle and did not, in my experience, really have very many teachers, just teachers of color at all.
So my name is Jesse Hagopian, and I identify as black and mixed race. My mom is of Armenian descent, and her family came here. Actually, my great-grandfather, Ardash, came here on my mom's side from Armenia during the genocide. He actually left Armenia. It was out of the country during the genocide that our government doesn't acknowledge, one of the few in the world that doesn't acknowledge it. And then he came here to escape that. And on my dad's side is black and survived a different kind of genocide. And that struggle really informs a lot of my perspective. And as a student, I went to Garfield High School, and you know, that perspective was missing from a lot of my classes. And I had very few teachers of color. I had one teacher, Paulette Thompson, that I really connected with. A wonderful teacher here in the Seattle Public Schools that was in one of our progressive education programs, a middle college that got pushed out and shut down, and it's really a shame.
Good evening. Again, my name's Joy Williamson-Lott. I identify as a black cisgender woman. And I'm not from Seattle. I'm a transplant. I'm from a suburb of Chicago. And growing up, I had two black female teachers in my grade school years, and that's because they taught the school. There were two different classrooms, And my parents specifically requested for me to be in those classrooms. And that might have been the last time I had a teacher of color until I got to college. But I just want to say one of the things that I got out with the biggest impact that I had with a teacher, when I went to college, I didn't have a major for 2 years. I was just kind of there, hanging out. I was taking classes. And I double majored in psychology and speech communications, but I'm a historian of education. That's what I got my master's and doctoral degrees in. And it's because I met a black male professor who was a historian of education who changed the course of my life. And he is, that experience with him, he is the reason that I am the historian of education that I am today. And so I just use that as an example of, I write about black people, and I've never had to explain why I thought that was important or valid, or that I could be objective in his presence in a way that I had to do in other contexts.
Nathan Simoneau. I grew up in Southern California from the IE. I, of course, had lots of teachers that look like me, so I'm white, and I'm also part of the LGBT community. I, however, though, had zero teachers ever growing up that were LGBT. I now know that I had three teachers in high school that that were all lesbian, two of them that were actually married to each other. But at no point did I ever have a gay teacher growing up, ever. And certainly never had a more effeminate man at the front of the classroom ever in my education.
Good evening, my name is Sharon Navas. As my bio says, my mom is from Guatemala and my dad's from El Salvador. I'm Latina, CIS female, and I went to both private and public education in New York City. So I had no teachers of color. I had a bunch of nuns, Attila the Nun and Conan the Librarian. You know who you are. I had a few teachers who later on came out as part of the LGBTQ community, but otherwise, growing up in a Catholic school, it was just not something you ever talked about.
Okay, I thought Joy talked a little bit about history, and I thought we'd talk a little bit more about history. As I was just talking about, and I think all our panelists know, there is a big mismatch in our state today and in the nation today, with, you know, a much higher percentage of white teachers, when there's a much, again, when the student population is growing ever more diverse. But it wasn't always that way. And Joy, as historian of education, thought you could tell us a little bit more about why that is.
Well, as I'm hoping all of you know, it was illegal for black and white children to go to school in the South. Right? You remember that from your history class? And so that necessitated black teachers for those schools. These were I'm talking particularly about public schools, public K through 12. And so there was a huge teaching force, a black teaching force in the South. There were black teacher professional organizations. There were all kinds of other kinds of professional development and systems and things in place that bound black teachers together to work towards different things to improve the quality of the curriculum, their own professional development. Many of them were highly educated. They had master's degrees, which wasn't a requirement, but white places wouldn't hire them, so they end up at black schools. And there were, I think what what people usually think of when they think about segregated education in the South for blacks is that it was necessarily substandard, and that is not accurate. It is not an accurate depiction of the way black educational history was. There were some schools struggled, but there were other schools that had students, even in the late 19th century, that's like 1899, I think, around in there, where there was a school in Washington, D.C. There's a person in the audience here who's got a family member who had gone, your mother, had gone to Dunbar High School in Washington, D.C., and students there had, black students there had black teachers who had master's degrees. They outperformed local white students on standardized tests. They were performing incredibly well. So then the Brown versus Board of Education decision happens, and nothing turns on a dime. Mississippi didn't desegregate its schools until 1970. They said that was with all deliberate speed, 54 to 1970, or 55 to 1970. And what happens is that all of those black teachers, all of those black superintendents, all of those black principals, and janitorial staff, and all these, everybody is fired. And so it's not that these black teachers found new jobs in these now, quote unquote, desegregated schools. They were out of work. And the teaching force has never recovered. So that's the South. But in the North, black teachers weren't being hired either, except in these local black communities. And so you have, because another thing I don't want you to leave you with is that racism only exists in the South. It exists everywhere. And so black teachers, there have been a variety of mechanisms that have been used to keep black teachers out of the profession, to create, it can be incredibly hostile space for teachers of color, not just black teachers. But the point is that now the teaching force looks a particular way, but it's that's been, if not part of some grand conspiracy, somewhat intentional in the way that it's happened. But I think people just assume that black people aren't attracted to teaching. They were. But I think for a lot of kids of color, not just black kids now, probably the thought of aspiring to be a teacher makes no sense because they see their teachers as, I see kids in the audience, as nobody they want to aspire to be like. And so why would you want to become that? It's another reason that I think again, this is kind of intentional, semi-intentional. It's consequential. So my point is that there's a history as well as a present that helps to keep the number of teachers of color low.
What do some of the other of you think about that? Agree, disagree, add on?
I just wanted to add on real quick. I appreciate you sharing that history. And one of the things that I'm most inspired by is Mamie Till, Emmett Till's mom, who was a teacher in Chicago. A black woman who transformed the United States by having an open casket for her son who was lynched in the South. But what people don't usually know about Mamie Till is, as a teacher in Chicago, she didn't just do that one watershed moment that showed people the brutality of this country against black children, but she also was a teacher that fought against the discrimination of black teachers in Chicago. So they used to give teachers an oral exam, and if they had a black dialect, that was a way that they kept them from having a full-time job. And instead, they would give them substitute jobs, and they would be on part-time salary without benefits, etc. And just to say that racism isn't a Southern thing, right? And that it's been something we've had to fight the entire history of this country, and we're in the struggle again today in many different ways. And just to say about what's happening to the black teaching force that has historically been a place for at least some upward mobility for black communities that have faced an intense amount of institutional racism, but those teaching corps are being destroyed. And actually, if you haven't read the story in Mother Jones that came out a few months ago about the disappearance of black teachers, you should check that out. It shows that we've lost 26,000 black teachers in the last 8 years in the United States. So it's not just that we aren't recruiting more teachers into a diverse teaching corps, it's that we're actually wiping them off the map by the tens of thousands. And why and how is this happening? Well, I believe that this whole debate around education reform, we have the richest people the world has ever known, right, using their wealth to implement reforms that have nothing to do with actually improving education. So we get all this talk about more high stakes testing. The agenda by the richest people in the world is put more high-stakes tests, bring in common core state standards, and privatize education with charter schools. And those very reforms have a large role to play in pushing out black teachers all over the country. So in New Orleans, where they moved to 100% charter school, right? Now you push out the union that was protecting a lot of those black teaching jobs, and you bring in Teach for America, and that actually has brought in a whole lot more white teachers, and the similar process has played out in Chicago and Philadelphia. And I think we have to actually stand against the corporate education reform agenda for an equity agenda.
So while we're on the topic of teachers, you know, I think many of you agree that it's important that we have a more diverse teaching force. And I was wondering if I could again ask you to share some of your own personal experiences to help us understand why that's so important, or why you think that's so important, if you think it's important. Who would like to start? I think I primed you guys for this, so I hope you have stories ready.
You know, when I went to school, I have, just a little bit of context, my parents migrated to this country. My dad migrated because of the civil war in El Salvador, and my mom was sent here to help the family back home. So her job was to come here, get a job, and send money back home. And for my parents, they wanted to instill the values of the Latino culture in me while I was growing up. But at the same time, I grew up in America where, you know, you go to prom, you go to college. You know, it's just a very different mindset, and I didn't have someone in school to help me navigate how to have both of those conversations at the same time. Like, I didn't have someone in school to help me navigate how to really explain to my parents what the SAT was or the PSAT was, or why AP classes were really important, or the culture of going to college, because I did go to a private school, but I'm what people would call the privileged poor, because my parents both worked 20-hour days to send me to private school. They had bought a house in a really, really crappy neighborhood in New York, and my one option to go to public school was to go to the fifth lowest performing school in New York State. So to go to that and then have this aspiration from the people that my mom was working for as a housekeeper that, you know, I have to go to college and that's just the way it is. I didn't have anybody in, as a teacher, as a mentor, as an adult, to really help me navigate how to have that conversation, and also how to navigate being Latina in America. I had to explain to my friends what a quinceañera was and, like, why I had such a huge dress and, like, you know, and the birthday cake was 8 feet tall and, like, you know, a DJ and a mariachi and all that other stuff. Like, they didn't understand what was all of this, and they thought I was getting married, and it was just really weird. You know, but at the same time, I also had to explain to them, like, I can't go out till 2 or 3 in the morning on a Tuesday because I had a curfew, and, you know, this was college. Like, I still go home. I'm 42 years old. I go home. My fiance's in the audience. He'll tell you. We go home. My mother's like, you'll be home by 10. I'm like, well, I'm getting married. She's like, I don't care. Like, you're in my house. You know, but I didn't have anybody that looked like me and could explain to my parents, like, what education was in this country. And no one explained to my parents that in this country, parents are engaged, and parents are assumed to be engaged. And if you're a parent in this country and you're not engaged, you're a bad parent. And no one explained that to my mom, who was working she would clean two houses from 7 a.m. to 1 p.m., take a nap from 1:30 to 2:30, and then do the graveyard shift from 3 p.m. to 11 p.m. at the hospital, and then come home and sleep from 11:30 to 6, and be up to get my dad to go to work. Like, to her, that was as engaged as she could be. To the educational system that I was going to, my mom was a bad mom because she couldn't go to a PTA meeting. right? And not having someone in, I'm getting emotional, not having someone that could explain that to me so that I could explain it to my parents was a betrayal of the educational system, because my mom was doing the best that she could to send me to private school, and to the people at the private school, my mom was deficient.
I mean, as our country is incredibly diverse, I don't see how you could argue that the teaching force shouldn't be equally diverse. If you're a white person in the audience, we don't understand what it's like to go through education and necessarily never see someone at the front of the room who speaks, who acts, who has the same manners as your parents, and what that means for a young person to never have essentially their parent up at the front of the classroom for them is incredibly difficult. I guess if you're in the audience and you want to like hide behind your whiteness and you want to be like, oh, but it's not that important that people, you know, it should just be great teachers is what matters. Think of it. So if we must hide behind whiteness, think of it as if you're getting 90% of your teachers are coming from one column, you're not getting the best and the brightest because you're going really deep down that column to have to hire that 90%. So if it bothers you that, oh, but we shouldn't have to talk about that, good, then just look at the data of like picking at the top from all columns. But I can speak from as an LGBT person, what it would have been like for me to have a teacher in the front of the classroom who, I mean, it would have changed my life for me to know that it's okay to be effeminate, that I have a future in the world, that I exist, that there is space for me, that I'm valued, and that not just that I'm valued, but that I also can succeed. Yeah. Kids need to see that. Like, I can be a wonderful teacher to all my students, but I still don't look like all of my students, and they need to see people in their buildings that look like them, that act like them, that sound like them.
Oh, sorry. Some of the things I'm thinking about in my own educational experiences was, especially when I was in elementary school and was learning English, the teacher wanted to put me in special education, and my father had to challenge that, and especially as being a new immigrant to this country, he was struggling in finding the support that he needed to challenge it, and so luckily, I wasn't put in because that would, I think, have also could have affected my educational outcomes. And I ended up, you know, doing really well in college, especially in math, which is what they were also concerned about. And I'm a math teacher now. But one of the things that I missed, besides just having, like, I really wanted teachers of color, and I also really wanted critical educators of color, specifically in math, that could show me ways to use math to challenge injustices, because the only thing I really learned about was like cookies, like how many cookies do you got? And I really don't care, I'm sorry. But I really wanted to see like, how can you use that to challenge, you know, the water poisoning that happens and that's still happening in Flint? How can you use, you know, exponential equations to look at how we are, you know, with mass incarceration or what is happening with what just the deportations that's happening in this country. And there's ways that you can do math to do that, and that was never really shown to me. And also, or even recognizing like the contribution of my people, like Indians, we did a lot with math, we really did. But y'all don't know that. So I just think I wanted educators of color, and I wanted educators of color that were critically using my education and teaching me ways to challenge the injustices that are faced by my community.
Um, So I have a very vivid memory of being in third grade, and I went out to my parent-teacher conference in the hallway. The table was set up, and we had the little kid chairs, and I was comfortable in mine, but my mom and my teacher were squeezed into theirs. And I was very, very nervous about this meeting because only a couple days earlier, I had climbed up the vent in the room. There was like this huge vent, and you could get like halfway up it. And I hid up there so that I could let kids in during lunch and we could play in the room. And it wasn't a good look. And so I was really nervous about this meeting. And thankfully, the teacher didn't raise that there. She raised a bigger issue, which was that I was dramatically behind in reading. And she brought out my standardized test scores and put them on the table. And that image is seared into my memory. I knew from that moment in third grade until about halfway through college that I wasn't intelligent. I had the proof for you. I could prove it to you because I could show you my scores and tell you that I wasn't very valuable intellectually at all. And I had a lot of shame and deep humiliation. And, you know, I didn't want to take any advanced classes at Garfield. School was humiliating and a constant struggle. I had almost no teachers of color. Anytime I made a mistake in class, I assumed that it spoke for everyone that looked like me, and it was an incredible burden to bear. And it wasn't until about halfway through college that I found that you could actually understand race and that it was created at a certain point in order to hold people down, and that we could actually challenge it. And there was purpose to education to help us fix some of these problems that I began to change and to see a value in education. And what I've tried to do is give that to students. And when I see them organizing after Michael Brown was killed in Ferguson, the Black Student Union at Garfield led a mass walkout on the precinct and demanded justice, right? After Donald Trump was elected this year, students in the Black Student Union and many of the other student groups led a mass walkout at Garfield, and all over the city, students led walkouts, and over 10,000 students. And when I see those kind of actions, I know that my work as a teacher of color, as a Black educator, can be very powerful and important to helping to transform public education.
I think about this, I guess, in a couple ways. One is I resonate with exactly what you were talking about. Like, so being able to see yourself reflected back is incredibly powerful, because for kids, teachers are, besides their parents, like the only authority, the authority figures they interact with the most. And I know I used to say to many of my students, I said, I suspect that I'm the first person of color you've ever had to interact with in a position of authority. And for a lot of them, they're like, you're right. And I'm like, well, watch this. But I think it's important for students of color, it's important for all of our students, right, to see different ways of what authority, what leadership looks like. So that's one of the ways I think about it. Another way that I think about it is I now that I work in a college of education and I have children, I care very deeply and intimately about the kind of education future teachers receive when they're learning, and about the professional development they will get after, because I don't believe that you can learn everything you need to learn, whether it's about your subject matter or anything else, in that 5 quarters or whatever it is. And for me, I'm more interested in that the social justice curriculum. Like, you're not going to take a class on social justice usually. I mean, you might, but probably not. But I want teachers who are equipped to talk about racism, sexism, homophobia, colonialism, imperialism. So when things come up in their classrooms, when a student says something to another student that you know is way off, the teacher doesn't say, oh, I don't really feel comfortable about talking about this, and they allow it to happen. You know, because they're afraid to say something. So I totally believe that more teachers of color are necessary. One, because they diversify teacher education programs and force those all the rest of the people to talk differently in the teacher ed program. Then they're going to force their staffs to talk differently in a way that they might have. They're not going to let things continue to go down the way that it's been going down. You know, trying to do honors for all, that's incredibly important, getting people on board with that. There are all kinds of allies, and so diversifying the teaching force is just one mechanism to instill, my point is, to instilling more and more change throughout the system, and then eventually into the principal ranks. That's another place that's incredibly important, superintendency.
Well, thank you. That was a great segue to the next question, which was, as we were preparing for this panel, you know, we talked about the fact that, yes, given there's, it's very important to diversify the teacher workforce, but Education So White is about a lot more than that. It's about the curriculum. It's about policies. It's about finance. What about those things? What changes would you like to see in those areas? Because it's not just about who's at the front of the classroom. Sharon, do you want to start
That's
on
me.
That one?
All righty. So I'm not going to tackle all of that because I don't have that much time.
Okay, one example.
But so the thing about finance, which is super sexy, the thing about finance is that we as a people, we as an individual, we as a nation, we as a state, we prioritize, we fund what we prioritize, right? So I prioritize having a home, so I pay my rent. Well, now it's a mortgage, so now I pay more. But for me, having a roof over my head is a priority. Having food, having gas for my car, those are things that are really, really important to me. But also then, you know, we have these little, what I call luxuries, which are really necessities in my job, which is, you know, panels like this, professional development. There are things that we all prioritize in our life. The state does not prioritize educating black and brown kids because it does not fund educating black and brown kids. The state pays almost three times the amount of money to incarcerate black and brown children than it does to educate black and brown children. The educational system, the Office of the Superintendent of Public Instruction, they have allowed a system that perpetuates kicking 3- and 4-year-olds out of preschool for behaviors and actions that are developmentally on target for their age. So we're kicking kids out for laughing too loud, for being rambunctious, and for just being kids. But we're kicking out black and brown kids. We're not kicking out white kids. And we're doing that more and more throughout the K-12 system. And we know that the state has to pay for educators, and we need to value the cost of an educator. Paying $45,000 a year for one teacher in Seattle is ridiculous. Like, we need to pay, like, we just need to pay more, and that just needs to happen. But, and I'm just gonna do that, so here we are. But the reality is that the way that this state funds education, they knowingly perpetuate inequity. And they work on the assumption that the school board, the business office, and the human resources office of your local school district is going to put the money in the right places to educate the kids that that are in the opportunity and achievement gap. And that's a huge assumption, because we know that most of those people are white. And we know that most of those people probably don't live in the same neighborhood as their schools. So we're assuming that people who don't live in the same neighborhoods as their kids that they work with are going to prioritize educating those kids to get them out of the opportunity and achievement gap. And that's a huge assumption that we're working on. And it's the state legislature that's like, yeah, that's what they're going to do. And we have hundreds of years of proof that they don't do that. Plus, we have the most regressive tax system in the country. So if a huge aeronautical company were to pay its taxes, maybe we could pay for teachers.
Boy, time is going really fast. I just got the 5-minute warning that we gotta move. So I want you guys each to have a chance to say something quickly on this subject, and then we'll have like a quick lightning round. One thing you think would be important to improve that schools or anybody else, school districts or anybody else could do today to better support students of color. But if you want to add on to...
I would say ditto.
What she okay. said?
But anything about the bigger issues of curriculum or school policies, just make it fast so we can get to the questions in the audience. Just easy subject to tackle. Yeah.
Can I just add one more thing? Because I'm the shy one of the group. we can talk school finance. I can talk school finance all night. But I think one of the most important things is that white teachers, white administrators, and white people in the classroom and in the school building have to stop being afraid of talking about race. It is no longer fair for the few teachers of color to be put on the racial equity teams and try to solve racism. It's no longer okay for the one or two members that are the one or two teachers that are part of the LGBTQ community to end sexism and oppression. Like, it's not okay anymore. That was not a system that we created. It is a system that white people created, and they have to be a part of that conversation.
Okay, this is the light. I'm just reminding you, this is the lightning round.
Okay. I'll try to make, okay, so on this big question, I mean, one of the things we tried to do to engage the entire Seattle School District in a discussion about race and equity was Black Lives Matter at School Day. And we pushed an initiative in the Seattle Public Schools to ask teachers to wear this shirt. It says, Black Lives Matter, We Stand Together, and then I put a motion forward in our caucus that we add the hashtag say her name to talk about violence against women as well to the shirt, and many hundreds of teachers wore the one with this. And so when we did that initiative, we had 3 points that we wanted to get across with how we could advance an agenda of Black Lives Matter in our school. Number one was restorative justice instead of zero tolerance discipline. Right? We know the Seattle Public Schools suspend black students at 4 times the rate of white students for the very same infractions. We wanted to push detracking, and that's something I hope Nathan will get a chance to talk more about. He's had incredible leadership at Garfield with detracking so that we can get students of color in the more advanced classes, right? And absolutely. And we also believe very deeply in the need for ethnic studies programs, and that, right? That all students should get to learn about the cultural diversity that exists in Seattle, in our country. And I would add that we should add gender studies programs and learn about sexuality and women's liberation as well.
Okay. Who's next? Nathan? Joy?
No, I I mean, you can do your lightning round.
Oh, yours is the ditto. Okay. Nathan, do you want to add something?
Is this the lightning round one?
This is the lightning round, man.
Oh, goodness, so much to say. I think it would... So teaching is a political act, and I tell my students that. Talk to your young people in your families. Talk to people in your neighborhood about how if you want to vilify a teacher who wants to talk about race in the classroom, who wants to bring up homophobia or bring up social justice, yes, that teacher has a political stance in the classroom, as does the teacher who doesn't bring it up in the classroom. Silence in the classroom is a political stance. And I think we, especially white people, are very uncomfortable acknowledging that. And I think that is a huge step, especially white people in America, can acknowledge, is that silence is a political statement.
I'm sorry, can I add real quick? I forgot to say that I was amazed that 3,000 teachers wore this shirt in the Seattle Public Schools, and that there are many teachers of all backgrounds that are interested in having this conversation, and we need to fund the professional development, right, and make the space by getting these high-stakes tests out of the way so we can talk about what really matters in education, how to empower our kids, right? So there's... It's clear to me that many teachers want to have this conversation, but they need help, and it's time we reprioritize our funding towards the things we know our kids need.
Yeah, I really agree with a lot of you saying, and especially what hit home was that teaching's not neutral, and how we have sometimes like just gone after teachers for... brainwashing is what they say, or things like that, but it is a political act, and that silence really says a lot. And then specifically with what you're choosing in terms of curriculum, we need critical curriculum. We need curriculum that really prioritizes and centers community and ancestral and indigenous knowledge. And we also really also need to support teachers of color. And I mean, I have a community of my, I've been teaching for 5 years now, and actually will be leaving the classroom at the end of this year, which was really hard, but I found out that that's average. Most teachers of color leave after 5 years, and that's me now. But we really need to support us and to support teachers of color that are committed, especially to racial and social justice.
Okay, now it's your turn. People with questions can line up at the microphones, which I think are on both sides of the room. Is that correct? Yeah. Do I see anybody out there? Yeah, oh, there's someone coming. Also, I'll remind those who are watching remotely that there's the hashtag EducationSoWhite, and you can tweet your questions to us as well. So state your name. Oh, and I should also say, please ask a question. Please don't make a statement or a very long preamble. We want to get to as many questions as we can. I will cut you off and ask you to cut to the question. So state your name and your question.
My name is Marcia Cutting, and I would like to raise the issue of people with visible disabilities as teachers.
Is that... You have a question in there, or you just would you like the panelists to address, or?
Basically, I'd like the panelists to address. I mean, I have a doctorate, and in 23 years, God help me, of education, I never saw another teacher with a visible disability.
Mm. I think it fits kind of in the same category of people understanding that, or kids understanding that there is no normal, you know, I mean, that leaders look all kinds of ways and behave in different kinds of ways and are still leaders, right? And so that you want kids to not be shocked when they see someone new. I mean, part of it is because we live in kind of siloed communities, but I think it fits under the same kind of an umbrella that I think for kids to say, yes, she can be a leader or he can be a leader and be... what, you know, dot, 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 after that. I think it fits under the same kind of an umbrella.
Great. Thank you. Take one from this side.
Hello, Joy. Hello, we met in the parking lot.
Yes, we did. You tried to act like you didn't know anything.
Now we know each other. Where's your mom?
She's right over there. Anyway, so I currently live a little bit further north than I'm assuming most of you do. I live on Kameno Island. And out there, it's a much more closed-minded community. It's not very open to LGBTQ, and I'm pretty sure there's about 24 black people out there. There's like 24 of us. We don't have a group email or anything. Anyway, so I go to a smaller school, Lincoln Hill High School, which has about 140 students, which shares the same campus with another school who has, I believe, 2,000 to 3,000 students. In my smaller school, we have a more tight-knit community, which does have more white teachers, and there are literally no colored teachers there whatsoever. And I'm happy that you guys opened our eyes to this, because I'm pretty sure not 100% of us were we didn't have a stronger focus on this as much as we should have. And thank you for bringing our eyes to that, first of all. Do you think that smaller schools are more important for the development of youth in creating a stronger community so that students feel more supported when they're growing towards their goals and aspirations?
Great. Who'd like to take that one?
Small schools.
Teachers, a teacher, like think about cohorts and stuff. I think you as a teacher, professional teachers could.
I think small schools can be incredibly beneficial. You saw it recently with the Highline School District, where they've kind of actively tried to break up the small school model that was actually showing quite a lot of improvements in students' lives. There's things that larger schools can do to implement small school environments within a larger comprehensive high school. Garfield's going to do it next year with academies. Franklin already does it with their academies, so there's things that can be successful because large comprehensive high schools can be kind of daunting and you can get lost in the swarm.
Can I just add a historical asterisk to that? So one of the things that these segregated schools had in the South was what one scholar calls institutional caring. And so these kids knew that the teachers cared about them, that they lived in the same communities, they went to the same churches, their parents' engagement looked different, parental engagement looked different because parents were working, but they were engaged. There's different ways. And so institutional caring is one of the things that you can get. It's not inevitable at a small school, and it's not inevitable at a big school, but it has to be intentional. And so I think whether it's a big school or a small school, institutional caring is something that helps propel kids towards their futures.
And just real briefly, I would say that the most important thing is small classes, right? Because then it's about the relationship with kids between each other and with the teacher. And so we voted in this state to lower the class size, and the state legislature said, I don't care. We'd rather fund Boeing and you know the rest of these corporations than actually help teachers build those relationships with kids.
And I was gonna say something also really quickly. I teach at Seattle World School, which is a small school that serves recent immigrants and refugees to the US. And beautiful place, y'all should clap for it. My assistant principal's here and I love her. Thanks for coming, Patricia. But it is really beautiful to have just this community, and it made a really big difference for me to start teaching there and being in a small school where I see and know all of my students, and I'm in the hallway and seeing and knowing all of them. But one of the things that also is that within the district, we get lost. Like, we've been Seattle World School for 6 years and nobody knows our name. They still think we're SBOC. So I think that's one of the struggles, and specifically like districts need to do a better job, is supporting small schools.
Great. Okay. Go ahead.
Thank you. I'm Jasmine Rich, and my question was, given the recent unanimous $2 million approval for buses, what recommendations do you have for the communities, teachers, families, to help advocate for $2 million for professional development for the things that you're talking about? Drug and alcohol intervention, education for teachers and communities, where the city just approved $2 million, what would you suggest we can do to speak to the city council or the classroom teacher or the school board to focus that amount of dollars towards something that can, I don't know, make access the communities that are disenfranchised and marginalized in Seattle.
Okay. And you're talking about the recent city council decision to fund extra buses to have two school start times.
You want me to jump in? Okay, I would just say we're in an all-out struggle for what kind of society we want to live in. The eight richest people on the planet have as much wealth as the bottom 3.5 billion people in the world, right? All the wealth is being concentrated at the top, and that's the fundamental problem of why we don't have the resources that our classrooms need. And our state legislature is just being paid bribes by corporations to continue to perpetuate this inequality in the tax structure. So it's going to take a revolt to change this situation. It's going to take a rebellion of parents, students, and teachers uniting to have the social force to actually wrestle that wealth away from the people who are hoarding it and use it for us. And just some ideas for that revolt, I would say, one, I think that teachers could go out on strike and say, we will reopen the schools when you're ready to fund them, right? Parents and PTAs could make the same claim, right, and have a parent strike and say, we will send our kids back to school when you're ready to honor them. And lastly, I would just say that one thing I tried in 2011 was I went down to, before McCleary was passed, it was in a lower court that said that there wasn't enough funding, and I went and attempted a citizen's arrest of the state legislature. I mean, maybe we could go do that in mass this time. I ended up in jail. The officer didn't have the same interpretation of the law as I did. But we need to do something, right, to build this rebellion for the wealth that exists in our state.
Thanks for streaming this episode of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. This panel discussion, hashtag education so white, took place at Town Hall Seattle on June 15th. Thanks again to Jenny Cecil Moore for our recording. Tune in again soon.